And it is a great pleasure to welcome to the program for the second time a distinguished American military officer, namely General Richard B. Myers, who was for 4 years the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and before that had a long and distinguished career, starting really with fighter pilot in Vietnam. Is that right?
That's correct, Milton. Thanks
after
for having
your
me
training.
On, yeah, after the training and everything. And the idea was, at least in my mind, was to serve my five-year commitment, 1 year of pilot training, 4 years in the active duty Air Force, and then get out and go to work either with my dad or some other endeavor in the Kansas City area. That was always the plan, and somehow 5 years turned into 40.
You start this book, the title of which is Eyes on the Horizon, with a visit to the Capitol. You're sitting in the office of Senator Max Cleland because you've been nominated to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You have served for about 2 years as vice chairman. And, of course, you need Senate confirmation, so you're making the courtesy round. And he brews you a pot of tea. That's how we begin.
That's right. He when he saw me before I made the appointment, he said, "Do you like tea?" I said, "Sure." And he says, "Well, I'm really good at brewing tea, so I'll brew you a good cup of tea." And so it was 9 o'clock. The appointment was for 9 o'clock. I got there a little bit early, walked into his outer office, and there on the TV was the picture of the first World Trade Center tower in flames. And, of course, the banners and the news reports at the time was, well, we don't know what happened. We think an airplane ran into it, and there was all this. Nobody really seemed to know what happened. With that, we went into the meeting. We weren't in there very long before somebody came in and said, the second tower has been hit. Then we knew, well, something's not right here. And about that time, General Eberhardt from North American Aerospace Defense Command called and said, we have a lot of airliners that have this hijack code in their transponder in the system here in the United States, and I'm going to ask them all to land, and we're going to sort this out on the ground. And so that started that day.
And you hustled back to the Pentagon.
I did. I was and when I get outside the Senate office building and I'm getting in the car, my security guy comes up and says, sir, we just had a report the Pentagon's been struck. And, you know, I mean, that was a real body blow. I mean, okay, we've had the World Trade Center, both towers struck, now the Pentagon. And so as we hit across the Potomac River, we're on the 14th Street Bridge, you got a clear view of the Pentagon. There's this black smoke, some flames coming out of it, and it was like the worst movie, grade B movie you've ever seen.
As I watched transfixed, of course, on television, suddenly there's a shot at the Pentagon, and there's your boss helping to put out the fire.
Right. Well, the first thing I did is I called my executive assistant, Colonel Matt Plemow, United States Army. I said, is the National Military Command Center up? Because my thought was, I was the vice chairman at the time. My boss, the chairman, General Shelton, was on his way to a NATO meeting. So he's over the North Atlantic. He'd taken off earlier in the day. And I thought, I better get in there where there are telephones where we can start coordinating our response here. And by the time I got into the National Military Command Center, which was fine, except for later in the day, the smoke started infiltrating. But I said, where's Secretary Rumsfeld? Well, he's out helping triage some of the victims. But he was out there for a while and then realized, you know, I got to get inside as well. So we joined up there in National Military Command Center, spent the rest of the day together.
What a day.
It was, as I say in the book, when I finished the day, because the smoke had permeated most of the Pentagon, not in a dangerous way, but just as fires do, I opened up my closet to go home and where my uniforms were hanging, and it smelled very smoky. I said, maybe I ought to take these home and get them cleaned. And then I thought, this has been such a horrible day. There's been such tragedy, such loss of life. I'm going to leave them smoky for a while just to remind me.
And the very next day, you are in the White House for a National Security Council meeting with
Correct.
The president wearing your smoky uniform.
Yes. Yeah.
And I offer you, hand to you, a marked section of your very book. I wish you would read those three or four paragraphs that I've indicated.
This time, the president said, we're not just going to pound sand. That's a quote. He may have been referring to the 1998 cruise missile retaliation strikes in Afghanistan and Sudan after the African embassy bombings. Quote, the terrorists started this war, but we will finish it. We'll do whatever it takes to win. We're probably going to have to do a lot of things that are unpopular. If that means this will be a one-term administration, then so be it. We have to do what's right, end quote. He could not have made his intentions any clearer than that, and obviously we had to win. But the definition of winning eluded us in the early parts of our campaign against the terrorists. In fact, the definition of what it meant to win would vex me and the rest of government throughout my tenure. This was a very different type of conflict, one that didn't easily yield to conventional definitions of victory. It most likely would not be a victory in the traditional military sense. Of course, if we were not able to define winning, we all knew the American people would be reluctant to show the appropriate will, resolve, and especially patience. President Bill Clinton's two administrations had dealt with terrorism much differently. The early emphasis had been on apprehending and bringing to justice terrorist suspects. Although Osama bin Laden had declared war on the United States in 1998, the country as a whole did not take the threat seriously. Before the 9/11 attacks, the strategy was primarily to go after Osama bin Laden. Now a broader strategy was our only option.
It's quite fascinating that you raise the question in that very paragraph, and you say this was a question that was in the air, at least in your mind, maybe in the minds of many others in that meeting on that day, the day being September 12th,
right,
2001, the question being, what does it mean to win against this kind of opponent? That question persists throughout the rest of this book, and you end
right
with a sort of a reexamination, which we will talk about later, of course, a reexamination of the kind of war we are now in, which you label not World War III, but World War X. And that's the mystery. What does he mean by World War X? We'll come to that and related matters when we resume in conversation with General Richard Myers after these words. And we return to General Richard Myers. And, General, I return to, in this case, a dialogue between you and President Bush. I quote, Bush says to you, asks of you, with al-Qaeda in mind, what else can they do? And your response is NBC, which stands for?
Nuclear, biological, or chemical. I think when you're dealing with violent extremists who use terror as their means of getting their way politically, the thought that they could come up with fissile material, have a radiological device, or even a nuclear device that would create a nuclear explosion, or biological agents, if they use those, they could be much greater tragedies than the 9/11 we saw. And that's what you have to worry about. These are ruthless and they're relentless.
So NBC. Also means WMD, weapons of mass destruction.
Right, exactly.
And the concern immediately was al-Qaeda may get their hands on those or may already have their hands on them and will use that against us.
Absolutely. And first of all, going back to that day on September 11, 2001, the thing that I was focused on, okay, well, what's next? Is this just the United States or is this a worldwide attack that we're going to see unfold here? Is it running airplanes into things, or are there other weapons that are going to be used? All these questions, there's so much uncertainty. We knew pretty quickly that it was al-Qaeda. Fortunately, the CIA had the pictures, and they could correlate fairly quickly. But beyond
even though Osama bin Laden comes on or issues a tape a day or two later saying,
right,
we didn't do it.
We didn't do it, yeah. And then later takes great pride in saying we did do it, of course. But we had the pretty good evidence. The CIA had, the intelligence agencies had good evidence that was the case. But what was next? And so there's this air of uncertainty that surrounds this whole question. That one meeting that day, we didn't decide a way forward. We didn't say, well, we got to go invade Afghanistan.
Well, from what little I know from my own contact with the world of military intellectuals, is that basically in a situation like that, you fall back upon the prudential principle and you deal in worst-case analysis. You dream up the worst that might happen, and then you have to sort of act on the assumption that it will happen unless you do something to prevent it or counter it.
Well, in one respect, we did that. We went to a different defense condition than we were at, just to raise the level of our alert and awareness, not that we were going to have to strike anything, but more from a protective standpoint, and to put people on notice that we know we've been attacked. We know the president said very early, this is not a criminal act, this is war. And so there was a psychological component to that action. But you're right. Yes.
And then the first ultimatum that is delivered isn't directly to Osama bin Laden, but is rather to the I suppose, Mullah Omar, or at any rate, the Taliban chiefs in Afghanistan, and you tell them, give us bin Laden, or we're going to come in and destroy you.
Right. The president was looking for a way beyond beyond military, or before military means were used, to try to get the Taliban to hand over the al-Qaeda. And,
but you gave them a deadline of about 2 days.
Right. They gave them enough time to think about it if they were serious. And I don't know if they took it serious or not, because after all, Afghanistan is a landlocked country. We don't have any we don't have the kind of relations with the surrounding countries that gives us a good logistics footprint, and therefore you can't really do much until you get that logistics footprint in place. That was a lot of what frustrated us in the Clinton administration from going after Osama bin Laden. It was the same problem, this landlocked country. So we had to think through that. When the Taliban said no, then we had to continue with our planning.
You had to make some arrangements. It took all of a month or so.
It did take some time, and we found some good allies in Uzbekistan, mm-hmm. in Kyrgyzstan, and also in Pakistan. Pakistan, because of the Pressler Amendment earlier, which forbid essentially a military-to-military relationship because of the nuclear testing that Pakistan was conducting at the time. We had lost generations of relationships with Pakistani officers. They didn't know us. We didn't know them. So we had to start that all up again. As you can imagine, there was great mistrust on their side.
With regard to our action in Afghanistan, there's a wonderful contrast, which you do make reference to, between what we achieved there in rather short order and the bogged-down horror that the Soviets faced in Afghanistan. Probably the Soviet government fell when it did because of all the wreckage that they had brought upon themselves for some 10 years trying to control Afghanistan.
The Soviet Union at that point, at that time, approached it like a conventional war, and they were actually fighting an asymmetric war. We knew we were fighting folks, the more asymmetric part of it, so we decided to throw our lot in with the Northern Alliance, who had been fighting the Taliban for years. And the CIA had relationships with the Northern Alliance. Now, I got to tell you, as we were doing this planning, as Tommy Franks at Central Command, General Franks, was doing the planning, I mean, we didn't have 100% confidence this was going to work. We didn't know how willing the Northern Alliance was going to be. We didn't know how far they'd push. We didn't know if they'd push too far and decide they're going to try to rule the whole country. I mean, we did not know the end. But
who are the Northern Alliance? They differ ethnically from the rest of Afghanistan, don't they?
They do.
And, are they Pashtun?
Yes, and yeah. and they do differ ethnically, and they have their own groups of warlords.
Yeah,
and
their chief warlord was shot down in an assassination.
Right.
Just 2 days before September 11th.
There was a reporter infiltrated his camp, and the reporter was an assassin, and the explosives were in the camera gear, and killed him, Massoud. And he was supposedly, I mean, everything you read about him, he was a terrific leader. But so we threw our lot there. We used the one of the big discussions was, okay, who's going to be in charge? Is it going to be the Department of Defense? Is it going to be the CIA that's going to run this? The CIA had the better contacts. The Department of Defense had the more forces and the logistics to do it. And it was decided fairly quickly without any controversy, okay, Department of Defense through General Franks, you're going to be in charge of this, and the CIA will support. And
we're going to come to Iraq shortly, but first, and we're staying with Afghanistan, one has to ask what happened after the rather rapid victory, and has that victory held? Is the government of Afghanistan in power to stay, or is the Taliban coming back? Because we read lately that the Taliban is gaining strength, and indeed, some people are making deals with the Taliban.
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of things that say Afghanistan's on the right track. They have a constitution. They elected a parliament. They elected their leadership. just the fact they had elections is a big deal. Mm-hmm. The fact that people risked their lives to have these elections. There were the story that I like, and I think I tell it in the book, in the province of Bamiyan in Afghanistan, the women were all told, if you go to vote, we're going to kill you. And pretty credible threat, because not too long before that, there was a minibus where they took everybody off, and if they had a voter registration card, they were shot. So the women, responding to this threat of Bamiyan province, bathed and dressed as if they're going to their own funeral, and then marched off to the polls. Now the
they wore their Friday best, so to speak.
They wore, yes, they did.
Friday's their Sabbath.
Yeah, right. And they did wear their best because they were prepared to die to vote. That tells you that there's something in the human spirit that I think endures in all of us. And they wanted a chance to have some say in their future. Having said that, Afghanistan is a terribly poor country. The literacy rate's reported to be around 70%, and they virtually have no infrastructure, few roads, power doesn't get out very far, and no water. So, you know, if you want farmers to not grow poppies and grow crops, they got to be able to get those crops to market. They got to be able to irrigate those crops. They have to have power to process the crops and so forth. And so there's a lot of we're talking about probably decades of international help to make Afghanistan a viable nation. I don't like the word viable, but that's the best comes
of. Of course, we're sending more American troops in
right
now.
Right.
What is the objective there?
I think the objective is the Taliban has been they've had a resurgence. They have the benefit of being able to go across the Pakistani border, and I mean, for all intents and purposes, I don't think the tribes down there really care about the border. I mean, for thousands of years.
And the Pakistani government ceded them to the Taliban, that is, one of the northern provinces only
right.
a few weeks ago.
And if you go back through history, the Pakistan has had virtually no control over the federally administrated tribal areas. So there are areas there where the Pakistani government doesn't have much influence. And so they have a safe haven, and that's and that has to be worked with the Pakistani government, which at this time is going through its own stability problem. So, but the troops are going in to help with that Taliban resurgence, and that's probably a good thing to do.
Does the surge, as it was executed by General Petraeus in Iraq, is that the model for what we're now going to be doing in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's a little bit different. The surge in Iraq was primarily to stop the sectarian violence and make the Iraqi people secure. The real brains of the strategy, in my view, was not necessarily putting more troops in there, but what those troops did. They needed more troops to protect the Iraqi population from themselves. So the sectarian violence had gotten way out of hand since the Al-Qaeda, from the point the Al-Qaeda bombed this mosque in Samarra in February of 2006. And it went on for over a year before the surge, and then you were able to stop that violence. That was key. I think going after the Taliban is a noble thing, and raising the troops is fine. I think it has to be accompanied with political development. So the international community needs to help the Afghan government through its political maturation process, and also economic development. That's the only way. I mean, there has to be the people need to feel that the central government is helpful. If they don't, the Taliban will be helpful. The Taliban will provide them their medicine. They'll tell them where to go to school. Of course, they'll exclude the girls, but they'll tell them where to go to school, and they'll provide for their needs.
And they'll tell you if you're a male to grow a beard, or they'll kill you.
Of course.
Strange people.
Yes. Yeah. And but the Afghan people, I found they want to do it themselves. The ones I've met all ethnic groups, I think. And they're very self-reliant. They're very hardy, as you can imagine. They live in a rough a rough country in a rough neighborhood. And I found them to be wonderful folks.
We're about to pause for an update on the news. When we return, it is absolutely obligatory, and though I've raised this question with you once before when you were here, for us to go to the decision to institute the action in Iraq.
Okay.
And replay that. You were in there. You were helping to make that decision. You stood with Secretary Rumsfeld. I watched you many times on television on those weekly press conferences at the Pentagon. You stood there with Rumsfeld parrying all of the hostile questioning from some sectors of the press who kept insisting that there's no good reason for us to be there at all. You felt originally, and you still feel, as you make very clear in the new book, that there was and is very good reason for the U.S. and its allies to be involved in Iraq. We'll talk about that when we return in conversation with General Richard Myers. First, to the newsroom and Don Norton. And we return to conversation with Richard Myers. Again, I want to get the inside story directly on the decision that was made to go into Iraq. When did you guys first begin to think about it? Who indeed first raised the question?
It was in early 2000. And, well, the question was raised by others right after 9/11, and President Bush said, no, that's not the problem. I mean, I remember one incident, I think I have it in the book, we're at Camp David, where we're trying to decide, mm-hmm. okay, what is the way forward? What are we going to do about this? This was, I think, the Saturday after 9/11, and somebody was starting to articulate why we ought to go attack Iraq. And the president comes out, and he looks at my boss, General Shelley, and he says, am I missing something? I thought this was about Iraq, or Afghanistan, not Iraq.
Indulge me. Yeah. Who was that somebody who said we ought to go after Iraq?
You know, I'd be unfair. I think, to the Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, Secretary Rumsfeld, I've never heard him articulate that we need to go do this. But there were those that had the opinion that now's the time to go after Iraq and all these good benefits will flow if that happens. And, it's not a specious argument. It's just not. But the president says, well, I thought we were talking about Afghanistan and what I miss. And General Sutton said, you didn't miss anything. But so it was talked about early, but we were told in early 2002 to dust off the plan for Iraq, and for over a year worked on a war plan. Now it's clearly, when we say dust off a plan, we had a plan on the shelf for Iraq.
Well, should we make clear here that indeed in proper military establishments you've got plans for just about anything. There's probably a plan someplace in the Pentagon for our invasion of Uruguay, for all I know.
There are plans for some of the more for the major contingencies where you'd like to have thought through some of the assumptions you might want to use and some of the planning that would take place. Yes, that's correct, but not for Uruguay probably specifically. But so that was not. So we had this plan. We've always had a plan for a long time. We had a plan during Desert Storm, and then it was modified after Desert Storm, when the first time we kicked the Iraqis out of Kuwait. So that plan was worked on for over a year. During that year, the emphasis was always on: is there another way to do this besides force? Besides military force.
Well, what was it about Iraq that scared us or worried us from the beginning?
The primary thing that worried us was here is a country that has weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological, don't think nuclear, but certainly nuclear know-how. And
but they had demonstrated their readiness, that they had, and they had in fact used biological and chemical weapons.
They used it on their own populations for
and
population
also on,
control
on
and on
Iranian
their Iranians.
Yeah.
And during the first Desert Storm, they fired, rockets, Scud rockets into Israel and into Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and I think northern parts of Jordan, as I recall.
Did those carry chemical warheads?
I don't think they did. But we treated them like, I can remember, we treated them like they could because they could have. And I don't remember if they.
But then
had.
In more recent years, they were also shooting at us all the time, shooting at our aircraft.
Right. We're doing the patrolling the north and the south, the no-fly zones in accordance to enforce the UN resolutions, and they would shoot at us. And I think I make the point in the book, we're out, and because you're airmen, you're getting shot at, they're not hitting you. But they could hit you.
And we're doing those overflights to ultimately protect Iraqis from their government, to protect Shiite Iraqis in the south and Kurdish Iraqis in the north.
And to make sure their military did not prosper because of the UN sanctions, so their military couldn't grow, and just to patrol, right,
yeah.
And trying to keep the Iraqis, if you will, in the box. And they did shoot at us. But the whole effort that year then was devoted to trying to come up with some way to get Saddam and his two sons to leave. And you may remember right before the president decided to go to war, he went on national television and tried to get Saddam and his two sons to go into exile and do this in a peaceful way.
Were we sweetening the deal at that point, offering them a comfortable exile someplace?
I don't know the specifics of that. I don't know if they're known. I know they would have been worked out if they'd have shown any interest. Mm-hmm. I'm sure something would have been worked out where they could have gone into exile. But I also think we know now that Saddam never thought that we would ever invade his country. And from the military standpoint, even before the president made the decision to go to war, we were building up forces in the region to the point where we looked like a threat, but it didn't look like it was inevitable that we were going to invade, and we never built up the number of forces we had there during the first Gulf War because we thought we could do it with less forces, actually.
But then there comes a particular day when you get intelligence that Saddam and his two sons are off at some particular location. The Dora Farms?
Dora Farms. That is right before...
it's March 19th.
March 19th, and we're at war
2003.
The next day. But we got intelligence, and it was late in the day, Eastern Standard Time, that good intelligence from the CIA that, in fact, Saddam and his sons were going to have a meeting in Dora Farms just south of Baghdad, I mean right there on the outskirts of the city. And we had a long discussion with the president. And this is Secretary Powell, Secretary of State, Dr. Rice, the National Security Advisor, the Deputy Security Advisor, Steve Hadley, Secretary Rumsfeld, myself, discussing, okay, should we strike? And what are the consequences if we're successful, if we're unsuccessful, if there's civilians killed? What would that do to the overall plan? Because at this point, the president had decided we're going to go to war. He's not given up, or we'd almost decided. He still had a day left, I think, on Saddam's ability to take up exile. But we were pretty much in the war mode. And so should we or should we not do it? Would it be better? And we finally decided to do it. And in the end, it turned out that, the first reports coming out of there were good. Well, they hauled Saddam up, and he's blue. Okay, and then pretty soon, he's got an oxygen mask on, and he's blue. And then the next time we know anything, he's looks like he's fine. So it wasn't...
Who's giving us those reports?
Some people that the CIA was working with.
Who are on the ground.
Yes, yeah. That's what was said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how accurate they are, I'll never know. Somebody probably knows how accurate they are. But it was interesting because the target changed, too, and the target went from something that could be handled by one kind of bomb, and then it looked like they were going to be in a bunker, so that required a different kind of weapon. And we had to get the F-117s, our stealth fighters, because, remember, they still had all their defenses up. We hadn't taken any of their defenses out. War had not been declared. And we wanted to make sure we could get our air crews on target and off target safely. We had Sunrise to worry about because the stealthy aircraft aren't stealthy if you can see them, and you can see them in the daylight. So we had all these things to try to work around, and eventually decided to strike, had to strike. Obviously didn't kill Saddam or his two sons.
But then we start the invasion within a day or two.
Right, we did. And, in fact, we General Frank said, okay, the element of surprise, we thought we would have tactical surprise, which would buy us time, save us casualties. And now we'd lost part of that because we've struck.
Yeah.
And they must know we're serious. So we didn't want them to start either hurting their own population or making other preparations for combat. So we had to sort of change around. We had this vision we'd do air power initially and then bring in the ground forces, and we kind of did it all simultaneously, basically.
And it turned out to be a whirlwind victory. It just took about a month to get to Baghdad.
Right.
You run through in the book Eyes on the Horizon a four-part plan, a four-step plan that had been drawn up. And the last step was to guarantee the peace, which would be supposedly pretty easy. We did achieve victory in the sense of defeating the armies and taking Baghdad, and we had a lot of surrender on our hands. But an insurgency developed, which went on for years and years afterwards, so that the major war in Iraq was the war that we fought against that insurgency. We are still fighting that insurgency,
right,
though to be sure much of it has been contained recently. That's a great question that I will press, of course, after some impending commercials. Namely, what went wrong so that part four of the plan wasn't as successful as parts one, two, and three? We return directly to General Richard Myers after these words. And we return to General Richard B. Myers, U.S. Air Force retired, who was, of course, for four crucial years, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He has done a remarkably interesting, indeed, and inevitably very interesting, but I might add a very well-written new book titled Eyes on the Horizon, Serving on the Front Lines of National Security. And that is just recently published by whom?
Simon & Schuster Threshold Edition.
Threshold
Edition. Released this Tuesday on St. Patrick's Day. I don't know why they picked St. Patrick's Day, but they did. And so.
Well, they should have called you General O'Myers. I have, on this program, I've had many people say, and watching yet other carryings on television or listening on radio, I've heard many people, sort of from the liberal position generally, and critical certainly of the Bush administration, argue that was a war we never should have gone into. We were lied to. We were told there were weapons of mass destruction. They even sent the Secretary of State, former Chief of Staff, former Chief of the Joint Chiefs, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, up to the UN to convey these lies about weapons of mass destruction. But we never found weapons of mass destruction once we went in. That was cynically done by the administration. That was not the real reason. The real reason probably was that a cabal of neoconservatives, many of whom were Jewish, pushed us in that direction so as to produce some sort of advantage ultimately for Israel.
All my knowledge and all my experience in working with the president and the rest of the cabinet was that the sole justification for going into Iraq was the fact that everybody thought they had weapons of mass destruction, and that if they ever fell in the hands of a violent extremist such as the Al-Qaeda, that we would see another configuration worse than September 11, 2001. When Secretary Powell went up to the CIA and spent the weekend getting his facts together and questioning the CIA on their intelligence, and then went to the UN, I was even more confident that we were right, because I know how thorough a person he is, and of course everybody had it wrong. The UN had it wrong. The French had it wrong. We had it wrong. He clearly had the capability to produce weapons of mass destruction, but we couldn't find any.
But he had, of course, done so in the past and used those weapons, chemical and biological, against subject populations.
Well, all the logic pointed that way, and I think one of the big lessons out of this era is, we train people how to collect intelligence. We don't train senior leadership how to receive intelligence and how to think about intelligence. Intelligence is not facts. That's why they call it intelligence. Otherwise, these would be facts. And so the folks in the intelligence community do a terrific job of taking three pieces of a 10-part puzzle and trying to put them together and say, okay, we think this is what this means. And obviously we didn't have a lot of insight inside Iraq at the time, and we had some bad sources, as we know now.
Of course, there has been another overview that ultimately this serves the purpose of it frees the Iraqi people from a terrible tyranny, which has killed hundreds of thousands of them. And by trying to establish a democratic sort of government in Iraq, we are transforming the Middle East. We're setting a model which may ultimately diffuse to yet other nations, and that will somehow produce a better world, ultimately. And it does, incidentally, also advantage Israel in that it may reduce the level of anti-Israeli activity on the part of the nations that surround or are near Israel.
I think those are all good comments, and the rationale for each one of those is not bad in and of itself. The only thing I ever heard, and the only reason I think that we on the Joint Chiefs or the Secretary of Defense or any of us thought this was really needed, was the connection between weapons of mass destruction possibly falling in the hands of violent extremists. Having said that, I think an Iraq now that has a constitution, has elected government, they've got an educated population, they've got resources, things seem to be going a lot better there. It could serve as a model in the region. And you'd hate to think about what kind of Iraq would we have if Saddam were still in charge and Iran's coming up with a bomb, and would they be tempted to want to go nuclear?
I've raised the question before, and I've not yet pressed you on it. I now do so. Why did we mess up so badly on the fourth phase of the plan that we started with?
I don't know that we have enough time, Milt, between now and the next break. But
we didn't expect that insurgency, did we?
No, well, one of the assumptions, and this was not the only assumption, but one of the assumptions was that the Iraqis would be so relieved to be rid of Saddam, they'd take charge of their own affairs and off they'd go as a country. And, of course, we all know that didn't happen. That was not the assumption the plans were based on. But let me try to give a little context to this whole situation. There are those that say the planning for Phase 4 was not very good. I would say the planning actually was pretty good. It was in the execution of Phase 4. So why didn't we execute it better than we did major combat operations? Right after major combat, Iraq was pretty peaceful. I mean, the insurgency hadn't begun yet. The president makes the decision that we're going to put in a civilian provisional authority, Ambassador Bremer in this case, Paul Bremer. That was supposed to be a military provisional authority, General Franks or his successor at Central Command, for some period of time until we determine the country is stable enough to go to civilian. But we did that in May, right after major combat. And then, for the military standpoint, we put in a three-star commander of a headquarters there to help Ambassador Bremer with his task, and that was Lieutenant General Rick Sanchez, United States Army. Things then start, the ground started to move under our feet. The Al-Qaeda comes to the sound of the guns, so they become a threat. Baathist regime, the remnants of that say, wait a minute, we're not so sure this is over yet, so we're going to start our little insurgency here. Shia militias, not happy that they're not in total control yet, so you have that factor. You got the Sunnis out in Al-Anbar that not happy about being the minority, and so you have a very complex threat situation and challenge shaping up that by August you begin to realize, so we've gone from May to August, and by the winter of next year, by February, it's kind of reached the level of intensity that it stays at for almost throughout the rest of my tenure. And
then they're fighting, not as an army, but they're fighting in insurgent form. They're blowing themselves up and otherwise dropping bombs in market areas and killing lots of ordinary people on the street.
Right. And so, and yes.
As well as American soldiers.
These people, yes. And so the situation changed. We changed, but I think more slowly than the situation, part of the reason is we didn't have the good eyes in the battle space to know what was really happening. One of our typical questions was, well, how many folks are we dealing with? And we never got good answers. I mean, it could vary from 10,000 to 50. We never knew. By the summer of 04, we're a lot smarter, and we replaced General Sanchez with General Casey, a four-star, as a strategic level. We now have an ambassador because they have a transitional government in Iraq, and we bring in a three-star to work the tactical problem. So we take General Sanchez, a three-star, replace him with a four-star and a three-star, which tells you we weren't properly organized for part of that year and asked too much of Rick Sanchez, which we did. And we got a lot more serious about training Iraqi security forces in that after the summer of 04.
Still, we went on for the following 3 years at least, isn't it? A tie in the struggle between us and the various insurgent forces, Al-Qaeda and yet others, including the odd Muqtada al-Sadr and his
right.
large Shiite horde.
If you look at the level of violence perpetrated against coalition forces, the U.S. being the predominant force there, you could draw that conclusion that it was a tie.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the fact that the Iraqis adopted a constitution and were going to elections, and that's in about a 2.5-year period, it wasn't a tie at all. They'd gone through several transitional governments. They had the constitutional elections. Iraqis, again, went to the polls. Remember the blue fingers they held up?
Oh, yes.
I mean, they risked their lives to go to the polls. So there were some good things going on, but there was still too much violence. And then shortly after I leave office, there's the Al-Qaeda, who had sworn that in their letters, they said, we cannot defeat U.S. forces, but what we can do is stir up the sectarian violence to the point where it may bring them down. And so when they bombed that mosque in Samarra in February of 2006, the sectarian violence, that was the spark that got the Iraqis fighting against each other in ways they hadn't up until that point, which then a year or so later leads to the surge.
The last section of your book is a fascinating separate treatise on World War X, as you call it, the war that we are engaged in and will be engaged in for a long, long time, you seem to suggest. And this is an analysis of what you call global insurgency, which is different from the kinds of insurgencies that have been encountered earlier by us or by the British, say, in Malaysia or what have you. And that needs full development in our conversation, and I will hope that we might do that directly after we pause for an update on the news. So we will return to Richard Myers talking about the new mode of war in which we are engaged. First to the newsroom and Paula Cooper. And we return to General Richard Myers. We're drawing from his excellent new book, and we can't do full justice to it in a mere 2 hours, punctuated by many commercials. But that book is titled Eyes on the Horizon, Serving on the Front Lines of National Security, Simon & Schuster, the publishers. The book has just appeared and is available, obviously, wherever they sell real books. we come to the last section of your book, which really quite fascinated me. It has to do with the kind of war that we now face in the world. Do please explain.
Well, as we got into this conflict, I think it was in late 2004, mid-2004, I have about a year left in my term, and I'm thinking, we're involved in Iraq, we're involved in Afghanistan, we've got forces in the Horn of Africa, we've got forces around the world that are dealing with the threat from al-Qaeda, but is this really the threat we face, or is there something more? And I took five really smart colonels and lieutenant colonels and asked them to go to National Defense University and squirrel themselves away and think about this. And when they came back, then we started working this issue, and what we came up with was this notion of a global insurgency, that what's really going on here is a loose association of violent extremists that are trying to delegitimize governments essentially around the world. And if you look at the violent extremist groups, and it turns out the ones we're mostly talking about are the Muslim groups, but in Thailand or Indonesia, certainly across North Africa, the Horn of Africa, and throughout the Middle East, there are these loose groupings of violent extremists that want to bring governments
down. You say someplace in the book that al-Qaeda used to be a hierarchy. It is now essentially a franchise.
Right, and that we happened as soon as we start to isolate Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri, and well, they can't conduct operations like they were doing freely before in Afghanistan, in their sanctuary in Afghanistan. They had to franchise their operation. And this is, and some of these loose groupings of extremists are connected to al-Qaeda. Some are not. They just have this extreme vision of Islam. And my basic tenet is, if we don't come up with a strategy that looks broadly at what's facing us, then fighting the conflict in Iraq, fighting the conflict in Afghanistan is not enough. And that the world's not going to be a safer place for our children and our grandchildren if we don't deal with the overarching issue of this global insurgency.
And looking to the motives of those who are attacking us, those who are running the global insurgency, you discover or you come up with a very interesting special illumination, namely that there is a war within Islam itself.
Yes, this is the conflict within Islam that many people have talked about. The violent extremists would like to have you believe this is a conflict between Islam and the West. It's really a conflict within Islam that has to be resolved within Islam. I talk about how our voice is not going to be listened to. They're not going to listen to the West on how they resolve this. And however they come out of this conflict within Islam, I think they have to do that. The Muslim world has to do that on their own. I think our only concern ought to be, and I talk about it in terms of red lines, whatever solution they come up with, how Islam's going to adapt to modernity, the thing we have to concern about are they going to turn to a violent expression that, as we've seen with groups like al-Qaeda, that we can't tolerate. Almost anything else we can tolerate. And whatever form of governments, I mean, that's their business. But that's the struggle. And so somehow we have to come up with a strategy that will predominantly not be military, will be more economic, more political, more diplomatic, more informational strategy, involve the whole international community to deal with this. And it's probably like the Cold War. If people go back to right after World War II, when it looked like communism was going to take over the world in France and Italy, the communists were in took charge in China. It was pretty bleak, so it took us 3 years, came up with a strategy we called a containment, and then decades later we had success, and now we have free Eastern Europe and so on. This is the same sort of thing, and what I'm suggesting is we need a broad strategy to deal with this thing we call violent extremism, and it's going to take decades.
Well, what are the main points in that strategy?
I think the main points are that we've got to help nations that are struggling, either economically or politically or training their armed forces to deal with their insecurity. We've got to enable the moderate Muslim voices to be heard without being seen as propping anybody up. It's got to be done in a very, very subtle way. But the main points go back to bringing all our instruments to power to bear. It's one of the things We haven't touched on it, Milt, but I think we would have been more successful faster in Iraq and clearly yet to do in Afghanistan if we'd have harnessed all our instruments of national power. I've served under President Clinton, under President Bush. This is a real, it's a problem for the United States of America to harness all our instruments of national power. The easiest one to rely on, the one that's going to do exactly as the president says, is going to be your military. The rest of them might not have the manpower or the dollar resources to do what you want them to do. And yet they're all needed if you're going to make progress against insurgencies. That's what history tells us.
One problem we have had, and another resource which has sometimes been rather lacking in performance, is, of course, intelligence.
Of course. And that's, you know, that clearly was what led, one of the things that led to 9/11 itself was the fact that the FBI and the CIA did not have good mm-hmm. communications in terms of the sort of intelligence they were seeing, partly because they thought it was illegal. But a lot of that has been worked now. I think our intelligence apparatus is, it was clearly a D-minus or before 9/11. It's probably a C-plus or B-minus today. And we've had we've reorganized our whole intelligence community. We had the Intelligence Reorganization Act that Congress passed that it created the Director of National Intelligence. So there have been a lot of things that have been done to help that.
We will be going to the phones in just a few minutes. Our phone number, 591-7200. We're opening the lines right now. 591-7200-312, of course, the area code, if you're calling long distance. And also, we have available infinite opportunity on email. The email address, extension 720 at tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune, tribune.com. Or, again, for phones, 312, then 591-7200. Any questions you want to raise to the former head of the Joint Chiefs, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, namely General Richard Myers. Any such questions? Now's the time to pose them. And we'll be directly with you in just a few minutes. Last matter, just of local interest, perhaps. We haven't talked much about the personalities you've dealt with, though you do characterize them to some degree in the book. Your thoughts about George Bush as a man, as an administrator, as a wartime president?
My view, of course, would be the military view, looking at our commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. I think that one quote that you had me read there at the beginning where he says, we're going to do what's necessary. It may not be popular, but we've got to do what was right. I think that guided him through his 8 years. He was clearly, visibly, and emotionally shaken by the fact that America was attacked and 3,000 people died on September 11, 2001. And he was bound and determined, and the rest of the administration, and I have to say I was one of them, was bound and determined not to let that happen again. And I think that drove a lot of his decisions while he was in office. He was decisive. He listened. He insisted that we all had a chance to say our piece, whatever our piece was. And that was not just me as a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but the other Joint Chiefs of Staff who are made up of the service chiefs and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So. But that's not untypical. I saw the same behavior in President Clinton. He certainly listened to his military advisors.
When I first came to Chicago in the mid-1960s as a young academic at the University of Chicago, I found myself at the university one day in a conference on the draft, of all things. And one of the participants was a young congressman from the northwestern suburbs of Chicago. His name was Rumsfeld. And this area still thinks of him as sort of a native son. You worked for him. You must have had an encounter with him even on his first term as Secretary of Defense.
Not on the first term. I was somewhere else when he was in the Pentagon mm-hmm. as the youngest Secretary of Defense, and I had no idea that he would pick me to be the next chairman or recommend me to the president. I don't think we got along real well when he came in as the new Secretary of Defense and I was sitting there as the vice chairman. I thought we had some really spirited debates, and I said, Mary Jo, he'll pick somebody else and that's fine. I'm not campaigning for anything, but we ought to figure out what we're going to do next. And then next thing I know, I'm the chairman. I think the most important thing for people to understand is that we have civilian control of the military in this country. the military can't pick its bosses, and what you would like is to have a relationship between the senior military and the Secretary of Defense that's based on trust. So all the cards are on the table. Nobody's hiding anything from anybody else because the lives of the men and women of our armed forces are at stake. The security of our country is at stake. And it takes effort, like any relationship, to build that trust. And we were building that trust up after I was a chairman. Of course, 9/11 had happened, and 7 days later we were in Afghanistan. We became, I think, very trusting of each other. And there wasn't a decision that Secretary Rumsfeld made that he didn't pass by me, the ones the military decision.
There are those who fault him, and do they as well then fault you, or who should be involved in the replay of this particular question? Namely, the fault that is sometimes asserted is that we went in there too lightly. We didn't put in enough men at the beginning.
People have to remember the military plan is developed by folks outside Washington, D.C., by the unified commanders. It's approved, of course, by the secretary after he gets advice by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then, of course, the president would ultimately approve it for going to war. Nobody dissented. None of the senior leadership dissented on the plan going in. And it's one of these debates. The person I listened to mostly was General Abizaid, who later became General Frank's replacement and ran all of Central Command. He has his master's in Arabic studies out of Harvard. He's Lebanese descent. He served in northern Iraq after the first Gulf War. And we would have these debates about how many troops are the right number. Certainly in major combat we had the right number because it was over in 30 days. The question is, how many do you need after that? And do you want to look like you're oppressors or liberators? And are you going to create more targets or not? And there are great debates. Everybody blames Rumsfeld for this. Let me tell you, we were all debating this all the time, and we came down on the side we came down on, but it was consensus. Nobody was being told, shut up and color, you're only going to have so many.
I found this conversation fascinating, and just like I found your book, Eyes on the Horizon, fascinating, but there's so much I haven't yet had time to ask you. One of the main items is, of course, Iran and the continuing problem they pose for us. But another is, and I want to cover this, if only quickly before we pause for some commercials and then on to the phones, the C4 system, command, control, communications, and computers. You seem to be saying here that we did so well in Afghanistan and in Iraq because of this whole new commitment to a very advanced kind of technology.
Well, we did well in Afghanistan after a while. When we first went in, we did not have the good command and control there. We learned our lesson. We went into Iraq. We had exquisite command and control, the Army, Maritime Forces, Navy, and the Marines.
And a great new targeting system, apparently.
And a very good targeting system. So one of the times where I got a little bit louder than normal in a press conference was when a lot of the pundits were saying, well, you're bogged down in Iraq. What they didn't understand was that even though the dust was flying and troops weren't advancing, through the dust we could see and we could target and pinpoint target the Republican Guard forces, tank by tank, armored personnel carrier by armored personnel carrier. We were decimating their forces. You couldn't see it. The reporters couldn't report it because there was too much dust, but it was happening.
It was assisted by global positioning technology.
Oh, absolutely. The global, yes. And which, an interesting note, by the way, when people came up with the GPS system that we all now rely on in our cars and on the golf courses and for our precision bombing, when that was first put up there, nobody knew what this was going to bring to society. And now it's almost like we can't live without it. It brings us precise timing and positioning all over the world for airliners, for everything, automobiles, the whole thing.
We pause right now and then directly to your calls and to your email. For phone calls, and I see one line available again, 591-7200. For email, extension 720 at tribune.com. We'll be with you right after this. And we return. We've been so involved in private conversation, which I've enjoyed, that I forgot to tell General Myers how to control the volume. You got it? It's the knob below the table on your left.
I've got it, but I'm not sure I hear anything in my headset yet.
We'll no, because here. We haven't yet started. Okay. I trust you can hear me, Andrew.
I can hear you.
And now we go to the first caller, who is Paul here in Chicago. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. Good
yes,
evening,
sir.
General.
Good evening, Paul.
It's beyond me that the Bush administration was unable to communicate to the American people, and the American people don't know, you know, a few things that I think are very important when we use efforts to go to war, like our allies in the Middle East, Egypt and the Emirates and Jordan and Qatar, implored Tommy Franks and President Bush to remove Saddam Hussein from power, and that, you know, the grand coalition that we had with France and Germany in the first effort in the Middle East dissolved in 1999 when they sided with Russia to remove sanctions on Saddam Hussein. And a vast number of foreign diplomats who were corrupt and on Saddam's payroll, 270 foreign diplomats on his payroll. I can't believe that still to this day the American people don't know, you know, that Saddam was funding the training of Ansar al-Islam through al-Qaeda. I hope you clear this up in your book.
I do talk about some of that in the book. And on allies, let me just make this comment. One of the joys of being chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is that you go around the world and you have your counterparts come to the United States to try to continue to build these really, really important relationships. And I would say, you mentioned France. With France, while they weren't involved with us in Iraq, they were heavily involved early on with us in Afghanistan. I remember talking to the French officer in charge of his special forces in Afghanistan. He says, well, you know, I outrank your army colonel here that's running this operation, but I'm going to subordinate myself to him because I think that's the right thing to do. The French were terrific on the military level. I think we could have done a better job of harnessing the power of our allies and our friends. Notwithstanding everything you said, but we could have done a better job of harnessing.
And there was never an explanation to the American people that President Bush was pushed to put the use of force on the table against Saddam, and once it was there, without compliance, you know, President Bush had to use force to remove Saddam.
I think, Paul, in the end, that's his decision, and he has lots of inputs in that decision.
Our thanks to the caller. Let's go quickly to another on 591-7200, and here's Larry in Dixon. Good evening, sir.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening, General.
Hey, good evening, Larry.
As you know, we've had the al-Qaeda fighters held in Guantanamo since the conflict started, because obviously they had to be kept there, or else they'd just go back to attacking this country. But I think the Bush administration, I mean, it seemed like their overall efforts were undermined by the constant domestic harping on the continued operation of Guantanamo, mostly because people said, well, they're being held without charges, which is falling back on the old legalism of the Clinton years. I mean, these fighters were obviously prisoners of war, I mean, which would have legalized their detention for the duration of the conflict, but no war was ever declared on al-Qaeda, never declared on Afghanistan. And I just wondered, was that ever considered? And in retrospect, by not declaring a war and then having this constant problem of what do you do with the prisoners, did that really hurt the overall effort? And do you really think maybe it was a mistake not to have a formal declaration of war?
Well, Larry, my memory tells me that we did have authorization for war from the Congress and did declare war on violent extremism. The problem is that this threat is, I mean, a lot of the folks at Guantanamo don't belong to an armed services because the al-Qaeda doesn't have an Army, Navy, or an Air Force. So you pick up these folks that are very bad actors that you have to detain until the end of the conflict, right. And you can't define when that's going to be. But if you let them go, they'll wind up right back on the battlefield, and we've got lots of evidence about that. So, I mean, you bring up a really good point. I don't think it's so much the whole legal issue here still needs some work, and it gets that kind of work, of course, from our Congress and from our courts and from the international community. It's not an easy problem to solve.
Over the weekend, we had an interesting comment from former Vice President Cheney being interviewed, I think, on NBC. He said quite directly that he thinks closing down Guantanamo puts us in a more exposed position, and generally he is faulting the new administration for various steps, the closing up of Guantanamo being one of them, of highest rank, taking various steps which increase the likelihood of our being attacked again in some massive way.
it's a good caution, because Guantanamo is, I mean, you've got to detain these folks somewhere. Some can be brought.
And you've got to interrogate them as well.
Yeah, you do. And some can be, and we did, some can be brought to trial. Some cannot. Some didn't commit war crimes. They were just foot soldiers in this violent extremism movement. But they've got to be held somewhere. I can still remember the CIA interrogator that asked one of these high-ranking individuals, and they got to know each other quite well, and said, you know, if you were released tomorrow, what would you do? He said, well, I'd try to come kill you and your family. That's what God wants me to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's and unfortunately, I think, Guantanamo has this very negative in the world.
You've been down there, I presume.
I have been. I went down there very early. In fact, I put it in the book. I went down there, and we took Senator Stevens, Senator Inouye, from the Senate with us, and met with the International Red Cross down there, because they were on the ground there as soon as we had detainees almost. In fact, we set up an office in the Pentagon, the Secretary did, just to monitor the International Red Cross's reports, which they are reluctant to ever make public, but we wanted to know how we're doing, basically. And so I think this negative image is much overblown. There was certainly interrogation down there. As far as I know, there was no torture at Guantanamo, so they get great medical care, they get good food. And what do you do with really violent extremists that if you send them back to some countries, the countries would kill them, like the Uyghurs? If they go back to China, the Chinese would probably deal with them in a very harsh way. And some countries won't take them back. Just this weekend, I think, or Monday, Europe said, well, we're rethinking whether we ought to take some of these detainees back in our countries because they're so dangerous.
Hmm. We pause for an update on the news, and then directly back to your calls and email. 591-7200 is the phone number, though all the lines are taken at the moment. For email, which is available in infinite supply, the address extension 720 at tribune.com. And with that, to Paula Cooper. General Richard Myers, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is our guest tonight. He is the author of the new book, Eyes on the Horizon, just published by Simon & Schuster. We've said nothing tonight about all of your earlier career. We just entered your history when you are vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, about to become chairman. But, of course, you graduated from University of Kansas, isn't it?
Kansas State University.
Or Kansas State, yes. Rather. Way back in 1965 or thereabouts.
You know, it's interesting. A friend of mine, a little bit older, came up here to Northwestern to school. So I mm-hmm. went and got the Northwestern catalog, and I'm reading it, and I said to my dad, I said, you know, I'm thinking maybe I'll apply to Northwestern. I don't know if I'll get in, but it looks pretty good to me. I'd been to Chicago. I, you know, thought I'd like it up here. And he said, let me tell you, son. He said, as long as I'm paying, you can go to any state school in Kansas. I said, okay, I got it. And then I decided to be a veterinarian and wound up going up to Kansas State where the vet school was and immediately changing into engineering. And ROTC was mandatory. So it's funny how things work out.
It is worth noting, is it not, that you were the top military person in the country for the 4 years when you were chairman, and you're not a graduate of any of the military academies.
No, and nor, if you think about it, Colin Powell, who was chairman, was mm-hmm. not either. Neither was General Shally Khosrowshahi, who replaced him. Neither was Hugh Shelton, who replaced him. Hugh was a North Carolina State graduate. Of course, I was replaced by General Peter Pace. He was Naval Academy, and he was replaced by the current chairman, Admiral Mike Mullen, who is also Naval Academy. So it, you know,
but you're an ROTC product.
I'm ROTC. What it says about the military is that it's a real meritocracy, and mm-hmm. you rise based on what you contribute to the mission.
With that, sir, back to the phones, 591-7200. And here is Rita in Barrington. Good evening.
Hi. I have a couple comments to make. I would like to say that I question the whole effort in Afghanistan and Iraq, given the history of a bad performance, given what happened with Russia and Afghanistan. You have 10 years of war, and then Russia abandoned it. And why did we invade Iraq when 15 of the 19 invaders of our space here, September 11th, were Saudi Arabians? It just makes no sense to me that the rationale was to attack Iraq.
Have you listened all night to this program, ma'am?
Yes, I have.
Well, then you've heard the justification that General Myers offers, but you should certainly respond again if you choose.
Well, Rita, thanks for your call. And on the first point about you seem to sound that or say that, you know, there's no hope for Iraq or Afghanistan. I heard former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice give a speech the other day. She's now long since retired, of course. And she said something I thought was very interesting. She said, you know, for those of us, for those that believe that there's no hope in Afghanistan, there's no hope in Iraq, that they don't want to be have a more democratic form of government, that they can't be successful and viable nations on their own right, she says that's a form of arrogance, more arrogant than thinking we can. It's a form of arrogance, I guess. So I'll just leave it there. And I think it's a good point. As I mentioned, in you know, Iraqis and Afghans went to the polls, risked their lives to vote, so they had a choice. So if you were asking an Iraqi, would you like a choice in your life or not a choice, they'd say, well, I want a choice in how it goes. Do you want good medical care for your family? They'd say yes. Do you want good schooling for both the men and the women in your family? They would say yes. That's what I think at this point. That wasn't the rationale for going in, but at this point, that's what we've given them. And in terms of the rationale for going into Iraq, as we covered, that was, as far as I was concerned, that was related to the potential of weapons of mass destruction falling in the hands of violent extremists. And that was, from my point of view, that was enough justification.
Thanks to the caller. Let me read you an interesting email that we've got here. I'd like to ask the general if the war planning took into consideration the religious dimension, in that Iran would become a major player in the region because the majority Shia would ally themselves together in both Iraq and Iran. Bush and his advisors' grand strategy of spreading democracy throughout the region, with Iraq being the prime mover to that end, was almost bound to fail because Iran was going to be a sharp thorn, and worse, in the successful outcome of this grand strategy. Can the general comment? Of course, what he's really saying, it's a bit discursive, is that the Shia, who've now gained power in Iraq, are closely connected to the Shia, who are the total power in Iran, and Iran is a close ally or a close friend of those who now rule in Baghdad.
Absolutely. And the question, that's a good question. It's an excellent question. It was taken into account in the planning, as I think he asked. And the academicians and others that we talked to about that, and the General Franks talked to, who put the plan together, it always came down to Iraqis would think of themselves as Iraqis first and Shia or part of that movement second. And they are Iraqis, and they're Arabs. They're not Persians. So there will always be the attempt, because of the religious affiliation, for Iran to exert influence into Iraq. But if you go back to the basic fundamental principle that Iraqis are Iraqis first, and I think we're seeing most of that play out, except for some extreme groups.
This is the proper point, then, to turn to the very last chapter of your book, which looks forward to some of the main problems that confront us at the moment and how we have to handle them. And one of them that you deal with directly is Iran and the threat from Iran.
Absolutely, and exacerbated by the fact that we've not had formal relations with Iran for decades. And it's a real problem, because Iran is a great nation. They've got great human capital. They have great wealth. And, of course, their ambition, but it's ambitious. But it's hard to deal with a country that actively supports terrorism, denies the existence of the State of Israel. I mean, it's hard to go to the table with people like that. I think we all have to hope that the Obama administration, as they look new ways to engage Iran, are successful. Now, the Persian people are wonderful people. One of my study mates in engineering at Kansas State, we had a lot of Iranian students. My primary study mate was an Iranian student, and we did a lot of work together, got to know each other quite well. I've been to Tehran before the Shah fell, and I maintain contact with lots of American Iranians just to try to learn what's going on in their country. So I would hope that at some point that the religious regime there in Iran would look to the greater good of their people. Their people right now are in quite economic distress at this particular point, and I would hope that they would look for you know, a way to move out of this standoff with the West and particularly with the United States.
What should we do about the threat, the danger, or the likelihood that they're going forward to develop nuclear weapons?
I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that besides supporting terrorism and denying the existence of the State of Israel, they're also clearly developing nuclear weapons. In fact, some estimates are that they already have them,
yeah.
And we've seen the delivery means that they've been developing right along as well. That is a real problem, and for a couple of reasons. One is, as I think somebody pointed out, they're a Shia nation. The Sunni nation of, let's say, Saudi Arabia, they're mortal enemies. They've been mortal enemies for a long while. Now, they have pretty good relations at the moment, but if Iran were to develop a nuclear weapon, then the Saudi Arabians have to think, gee, do we need a nuclear weapon or a nuclear capability to protect ourselves, to have the leverage to have a seat at the table when we're discussing things with our Iranian friends? And the other Sunni states there in the Gulf, this could really get out of hand quickly. And as radical as the leadership is in Iran, not the people of Iran, but the leadership, you know, you have to think if they had a nuclear device, they might just use it. One of their they support the Hezbollah, which is one of the premier terrorist organizations in the world. So this is a real concern. It's clearly a concern for Israel that. Where Iran has made statements that they would like to end their existence. So we don't have a lot of leverage, unfortunately, and I'm not sure we have a lot of military options. And, again, I go back to I hope President Obama can find new ways. He seems to be receptive to looking at new ways to dealing with Iran, and I hope some of those work. I would also say that Russia can be a good ally here. We have our relations with Russia right now are strained. But if we're going to have any sort of solution to the standoff with Iran over some of these issues, Russia could play a big role. They're a big partner with Iran in developing their civilian nuclear capability. They sell them modern weapons. If they wanted to, they could be a big help here. And they have as big a threat from violent extremism as anybody.
And with that, we pause for a last quick round of commercials, then right back to the phones on 591-7200. And directly back to General Richard Myers, and directly back to your calls for him on 591-7200. We go to Mike here in Chicago. Good evening, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. And General Myers, God bless you, and thank you for serving our country.
It was a privilege, Mike. Thank you.
Yes, you know, I just wanted to make an observation. You know, we are fighting communists. You know, communists by nature are atheism, so we didn't have to worry about them strapping bombs, you know, just blowing themselves up. And the enemy we're dealing with today, you know, they believe that they will be automatically taken to heaven and having 72 virgins by killing themselves. And their view is that, my understanding is that they look at us as the great Satan, and Israel is the little Satan, and they're not going to stop until we're completely destroyed. Does the government have an understanding and a mindset or understanding their mindset and how to deal with that?
I think, Mike, what you're referring to are the, is the what I call violent extremists, that extreme, those folks that have an extreme view of Islam that believe exactly as you described. You did a good job of describing it, because when they kill us and they kill our men, women, and children indiscriminately, they are currying the favor of God as they see it, and they consider us infidels because we're not true believers. I think, yes, I think our government, people in government, people that think about this a lot understand that very well. I would also say that this is, in my experience anyway, a very isolated or small segment of the Muslim population. Most Muslims, and I'm sure you probably know a lot right here in Chicago, they have no such belief. But that's the struggle. The ones that believe this way want to force their beliefs on the rest of the Muslim population. There was a map that Al-Qaeda had. I don't think it's up anymore, but it was a map on one of their sites that showed over 100 years how the world changed, and they would color countries red that became converts to Islam, and not only Islam, but extreme views of Islam like the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and others. In 100 years, the United States and Canada and Mexico were all red. So they have a long-range plan. There are those extremists that, that view it that way.
You say of them that basically to fight is to win, meaning that they've got to keep a perpetual war going.
Yes, and it's and winning is not the end in itself. Fighting is kind of the end in itself because they hope to gain converts, or if they get lucky and have some big impact, they could topple a government and extremists could take hold like the Taliban did, in fact, in Afghanistan. And certainly if you go to the Fatah areas of Pakistan, lots of extremists there. The government has, as we talked about earlier, has virtually no influence in the federally administered tribal areas. So it's a real issue.
Here's an email that touches on a related point. Your guest asserts that it may be in the United States' best interest to train foreign militias to combat, quote, insurgent forces in their own countries. I would counter, however, that we have, in fact, tried this policy before. I recall that we spent extensive time and money training a certain military force in Afghanistan to combat Soviet communism in the 1980s. It is now evident that we had been training and investing in al-Qaeda, our current sworn enemy. How are we to avoid such outcomes in the future?
Well, I don't think it was al-Qaeda, but you're right. You can make mistakes in this business, and I in the book I go into that, how you have to be. In some cases, it'll look like you're doing exactly the wrong thing. I think we can be a lot smarter about it. What I was suggesting is that for legitimate governments that have legitimate security concerns, but maybe not the resources or the training to deal with them, that we could help in that regard. I think you have to be very careful. Sometimes you're going to have to make bets like the one we made in Afghanistan that was useful at the time, but in the long run was not useful. Sometimes you're going to have to confront those paradoxes, and I talk a little bit about that in the book.
Back to the phones, and in this case, to Jim in Chicago. Good evening, sir.
Hi. Thanks for the discussion. Hi, General.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Hi. I'm fine. I want to talk about the Iraqi casualties in terms of the civilians. Dr. Rosenberg, almost as a sidebar, said 100,000 were killed, and I'm thinking if that is a figure which many human rights organizations say isn't even close. You talked about closing Guantanamo as a threat. Isn't the fact that we killed, besides our 4,000 kids, 100,000 civilians, babies, children, families, the relatives left behind are going to resent the West? Isn't this alone a fact that this war was...
I'd have to get in on this for just a moment and reformulate your question, I think. I wonder whether you accept this reformulation. No one is saying that we have killed 100,000 civilians, but rather 100,000 civilians have been probably killed, or maybe more, in Iraq. But many of those deaths, probably most of them, are due to the insurgency
no,
rather than to American
force. No, absolutely
not.
If we had not entered, they would not
well, you could argue it that
been
way,
killed. So isn't this war... on that fact, 100,000, think about that number, 100,000 people. I mean, come
okay.
on.
Okay, let's get a response.
Okay, first of all, that's a good question. But I think Milt's right. It's not that U.S. troops killed 100,000. We'll just make that clear. I would say we took great
care. If we had not entered the war, this would not have happened. So wasn't that part of the decision that Bush made?
It's all part of the calculation. Let me just, we're running out of time.
100,000, think about
sir,
it.
Sir, it's time now to let the general respond. Yeah. The time is very, very short, I fear.
The fact is that we took great care in our major combat to reduce civilian casualties. Our troops are the most professional in the world. You'd have to balance that off against what Iraq would be like today. Saddam killed tens and tens and tens of thousands of his own people. A lot of this violence was perpetrated by al-Qaeda that came to the sounds of the gun. You can argue, okay, if we hadn't gone in there, maybe that wouldn't have happened. But Saddam would still have continued his torturous regime. I mean, there's no question about that in his son's actions. I think most Iraqis, while not wanting an armed force in their backyard, respect the fact that the Americans behave in a very professional and a very caring way. I still remember the one Iraqi father, this is major combat, that they're caught in a crossfire. The Iraqi father picks up a son, and he runs and hands it to an American soldier he's never met in his life. He doesn't know who this character is. All he knows is he's got an American flag on the side of his uniform and hands him his son to protect him in this crossfire. You know, with nothing good comes about in this world that is easy. And it's a tragedy for the folks that have lost their lives, both the U.S. coalition. On the other hand, I think we can look to the future, a brighter future for the Iraqi people than they ever could have expected under Saddam Hussein.
We're just about out of time. Do you still get into an airplane and fly it these days?
I don't right now. I just don't have the time. I have the desire, and I'm hoping someday I can resume.
We haven't talked at all about your years in the Vietnam War. You flew some 400 or more hours in combat.
I had 600 hours of combat. I flew some very long missions. I had one mission was suppression of enemy radars, and we typically fly, 4 to 5 hour missions supporting B-52s over north of Vietnam. And then before that, I flew what they called a fast forward air controller. Mm-hmm. Fast meaning it wasn't a prop driven. I was in an F-4, and we'd fly 5 hour missions typically, lots of refuelings, and build up a lot of combat hours that way.
It's been a great pleasure having you here again.
No, thank you. So much. It's nice to be back with you. Thank you very much.
The new book by General Richard B. Myers is titled Eyes on the Horizon, Serving on the Front Lines of National Security. And Simon & Schuster are the publishers. We will be on the Internet program tomorrow night while hockey takes the air. And then back for Monday night with Ian Bremmer, an international analyst who's got a very interesting book about the growing international economy as it relates to warfare and as it relates to tension between nations. Tuesday, we talk about cosmology and astronomy with two people who practice that arcane scientific profession at the University of Chicago. For now, it's time to say goodbye to all, and thanks most sincerely for listening.